All right, it is Thursday, April 7th, and we are at St. Agnes Catholic Church in Red Lodge, Montana, interviewing Father Keith. Would you mind stating for the record your name, your birth date, and then your place of birth, please?
Okay, Dennis Joseph Keane, born 1938 in Galway, Ireland.
And how long have you been the priest in Red Lodge?
48 years in Montana.
In Montana.
Mm-hmm.
What parishes?
First of all, Great Falls, Lewistown, Livingston, Ekalaka, Baker, Chester, Chinook, Fort Benton, Columbus, and Red Lodge.
Wow, that's impressive. Have you been a priest in any other parts of the country or just
No,
Montana?
Always in eastern Montana.
Okay.
Yeah.
Always in eastern Montana. Okay. So when did you come to the United States?
Came August 23rd, 1963.
August 23rd, that's my birthday.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So why did you come to the United States?
The seminary that I went to in Ireland, which is in Tipperary, all the priests ordained there left Ireland for different parts of the world. Mm-hmm. And that particular seminary had a long connection with the Diocese of Great Falls, Billings, Eastern Montana. Because the first Irish priest came out in 1901 and he established that tradition.
Okay.
Now, not every year, but most years, somebody would come from that seminary as a priest to Montana. And one of the reasons that I came here was I knew that when I came out here, there would be priests here whom I had known in Ireland, and there would be priests coming later on that I had known in Ireland. So the continuity of it was a big part of my choosing to come to Eastern Montana.
So you were ordained in Ireland?
In Ireland, yes.
At which seminary?
St. Patrick's Seminary in Thurles, County Tipperary. Yeah.
So, I guess I just would like to, if you have any particularly interesting stories about being a priest in Montana. I know that being Irish, and obviously Irish, has sort of an effect in how people perceive you and just kind of what your being Irish and Irish heritage, how that has affected your being a priest in Montana.
The people were used to priests from Ireland, if you like, and so we found ourselves very, very well accepted out here, and they made a lot of allowances for our slowness to get into Montana ways, especially in the use of certain words and phrases that had different meanings back in Ireland than they did here. And which led to some embarrassing situations.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I was only here in this country for a couple of weeks, and a family invited me to their home, and they made tea for me, which I thought was great because I didn't like coffee. And when I was leaving, I used an Irish expression to thank the lady for being so friendly. And I told her she was very homely. So that would be an example of some of the difficulties we found with language, but the people were very understanding of that.
Mm-hmm.
People very understanding of that.
Well, that's good. What possessions did you bring with you when you came to the United States?
Nothing really.
Really?
No. Just what you might pack for going on a trip. Just some clothes, and that was it. Yeah.
What was the trip like?
I remember I flew Pan Am from Shannon in Ireland to New York, and first time on a plane, of course. And it was exciting to see the new world, you know. And I think part of the Irish personality is this wanderlust. We like to wander. And so it fitted into my culture that you would either spend your life in your native place or go halfway around the world. So I was very much in tune with my culture in going that distance. And Landing in New York, the first thing that hit me that I'll never forget was the humidity. It was a weather that I had never experienced before, never. And I was met by a cousin of mine there who took me to his home in Philadelphia. And I don't know how many hours drive, but one of the things I noticed about that struck me as different, sometime in the middle of the night we stopped to eat. And I could not believe that there's a place open in the middle of the night where you can stop and have a meal. I was being introduced into the American way of life very, very fast. Yeah. And then I flew from Philadelphia to San Francisco and then eventually up to Great Falls, Montana.
So Great Falls was your first
My first stop in
stop
Montana.
in Montana.
Yeah.
What were your impressions of Great Falls when you got there?
I came out in August and I couldn't see any green fields, you know. And I had never seen a landscape like that before in my life. Because in Ireland, all year round, every place is green. And I remember looking down from the plane and I wondered if there had been a fire or something. And then I couldn't see any great evidence of population or towns looking down. And it struck me as if I was in a total other world, like I landed on the moon. Everything was different.
So, did any family members come to the United States, or is it just you?
Just me at that time, yeah, just me at that
Okay.
time.
Do you have any siblings?
I was the youngest of seven kids, and at the moment there's just myself who was the youngest and the oldest. He's still alive in Ireland. The two of us are left. Now, my brother and his wife have come to Montana twice for a visit in recent years. In recent years, yeah.
And you often go to Ireland to
I go to
visit.
Ireland every year, yeah.
Were any of your other siblings in the church, or were you the only?
There was one girl in the family, and she was a Dominican nun who spent most of her life in Africa, but no priest. The others should have been instead of me, but they didn't.
Is there like a family tradition of priests, or were you just the first
I
one?
was the first one ever. The first one ever.
Interesting. What sort of family traditions or customs have you tried to sort of maintain while living in the United States that you brought over with you?
I would say one of them customs that I still keep going, and which the people here kid me a lot about because it's my main item of Christmas shopping. I buy a turnip. Especially in the west of Ireland, it was a strong Christmas tradition that the family Christmas candle was not put in a candlestick, but it was in a turnip. You scooped a hole out and you put the candle in the turnip, which you did not decorate. And the symbolism of it was the candle was Christmas and the turnip was a reminder of the famine. And so I still keep that one going. Another one in where I live, I have what they call in Ireland St. Bridget's Cross. It was the tradition in Ireland on the 1st of February, the 1st of spring, St. Bridget's Day, that all the kids in the family would get two little hazel rods about 3 inches long in a cross and then weave wheaten straw until you had, I think, what the Native Americans would call God's eye, that diamond-shaped cross. But the only one that was kept at the end of the night was the one that the father made. The rest were burned. And I still have one of those with me. Yeah. And I put it up in a prominent place every 1st of February.
That's really nice. Are there any traditions that you've given up or changed over the years?
I don't think so. I have held on to a lot of interests in Ireland, especially in the sports over there. And I must have still have over 100 videotapes of ball games from Ireland that I replay and replay over and over again. Insofar as I can, I think I, as I get older, I hold on to more and more of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you play a lot of sports as a child?
I did, yeah.
What kind of sports did you play?
The game called hurling, which is played only in Ireland. It's an ancient game. And the biggest difference between that and here would be in Ireland, we have no professional sport. It's all amateur. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, which makes it interesting, is that when we play for what you would call the national championship, it's single elimination from the first day of the season. And so that makes every game vitally interesting. And the big change that has happened in that area, for the first few years, if there was a ball game in Ireland on a Sunday, the earliest I could possibly find the result, no matter what I used, would be the following Friday.
Oh, no.
And now I can tune in on the internet to the live game. So that has been a tremendous improvement. Tremendous. Yeah.
So could you explain hurling to me a little bit?
Hurling. There are 15 players in each team. Each player has got a stick. It's about the length of a baseball bat with a narrow handle and then a little wider as it goes down towards the end. It's flat. The ball used, in fact, there's one I think right beside you there, somewhere, is about the size of a tennis ball. It's on the top shelf. Yeah.
Oh, I see it.
Yeah. It's made of solid leather.
Okay.
The scoring system is you have the uprights and the crossbar. If the ball goes between the uprights over the crossbar, 1 point, under the crossbar, 3 points, but there's a goaltender in there. It's a non-stop game for 2 35-minute halves. No timeouts, no huddles. 3 substitutes during the whole game and 1 referee. And the playing surface is 170 yards long and 100 yards wide. So as the main physical attribute is fitness. It doesn't matter what size, it's fitness.
Wow, that's impressive. That sounds like it'd be a fun thing to watch. So, did you ever try to organize like a hurling game when you were in the United States, try to teach people how to play it?
When I came in 1963, there were, I think, just over 30 Irish priests from Ireland. And once a year we'd get together actually for our priest's retreat, and we'd bring those sticks with us. And we would try and have a game. One time we had our retreat on the campus of the University of Great Falls. And what an ideal spot to have a game, until some of the nuns on the faculty caught us. The flower beds and the lawn was never the same again after we had finished our game.
So it must have been nice, at least, coming all the way to Montana, having sort of at least a miniature Irish culture already in place, not just of Irish priests, but of, did you experience sort of the culture of people of Irish descent there, like with the folk festival and stuff?
It was great to have that group of Irish priests, most of whom I had known previously in Ireland. And we had a long tradition of getting together at Christmas time. We would travel long distances. And then some volunteer would cook the traditional Irish Christmas dinner, which was roast goose, not turkey. And So that was perhaps the biggest time in our year, was getting together at Christmas time, a whole group of us. And because of the distances in eastern Montana, I found that, we all found that difficult at the beginning. We didn't have an opportunity to get together, because Montana is 6.5 times bigger than Ireland. And this diocese is exactly 3 times the size of Ireland.
Oh,
And so the distances were absolutely mind-boggling to us.
So, what languages do you speak?
Just Gaelic and English.
You do speak Gaelic,
Yeah.
however. Did you speak Gaelic a lot at home? Was that the main language at home, or?
Not at home, no, it was not spoken at home, but it was the only language we used in school for all subjects. Yeah. And my parents, when they would have been young people, would not have been allowed to learn or speak the Gaelic language, so they didn't have it. And so my generation, as we grew up in school, that was the only language we used. And where I come from in Galway County, there's quite a large part of that county. The Gaelic language is their first language. They speak it all the time.
Yeah, that's interesting that there was a change in policy and what stories have come down to you about your parents, your grandparents, and your ancestors that are important in your family?
Most of the information I have of them, I've actually gotten just very recently, because my surviving brother Paddy, the oldest in the family, put his memories on CD. And I found out more than I had known before about that our family, going way back, eventually came from present-day north of Ireland, where they had been evicted. And they found their way down to the west of Ireland. And that's three brothers came down, and one of them would have been my grandfather.
Interesting. So, do you know why they were evicted in North Ireland?
Well, evictions were so common that time in the landlord times, and they could be evicted for no reason. And usually, when a person family was evicted, their house was destroyed, and so they had no place to go back to.
So it was just sort of a greedy landlord
Yeah.
situation. Interesting. I have a question. Because this has come up in some interviews and in my previous interview, do you have any experience with the Caoimhín funeral traditions?
I remember one Caoiney woman in the locality when I was very, very young. She lived alone in a small thatched house, and she was, to us as little kids, a very mysterious figure, even though she was just one of the neighbors to my parents. And when she would go shopping, she wore a black shawl that came way out over her face, so we never did get to see her face, which added to the mystery of it for us kids. And if a wake was taking place, she'd be the first one there. And the first thing she would do is she would stop the clock, because time had ended for the person who was dead, so time should stop. And this is my vague memory of it, that actually she appointed herself in charge when she arrived at the wake. And she would just sit there. And the wake, I think, was an example of what I think is part of the Irish culture, that they bring together in the one celebration opposite emotions. And so if it's a sad occasion, they bring some joy into it, and vice versa. And I think that's what's behind the use of the turnip with the Christmas candle. You have opposite emotions right there. And so if the Caoimhín lady, the Caoineach, thought that things were getting just a little bit too happy, she would start to keen a wail, and that would bring back everybody back to their senses again. And probably at that time, probably somebody would start saying the rosary again or something like that. But I do remember that one lady in my parish.
So, do you mind telling me a little bit more about your childhood in Ireland? Was your family very well off, middle class, or?
I was raised on a farm, And I don't think at that time we really ever thought in terms of rich or poor, because if you were raised on a farm, there was always sufficient of everything. And growing our own food and everything else, curing our own meat and what have you. And I would say maybe average, using present-day terms, which I don't think we were aware of then, middle class, if you like. And the farms at that time were very, very self-sufficient in terms of food and what have you. And so it was a comfortable life. A busy life for kids, there was always something to be done. And that's why I have never been able to understand when young people tell me now that they're bored. We didn't have time to be bored. And in a rural area where the farms are correspondingly much, much smaller than here in Montana, a very thickly populated country, neighbors very, very close by. And there was a lot of neighbor helping neighbor without any payment whatsoever. They helped each other on the different farming chores, depending what it was. There was never a thought of money, but they would exchange time helping each other out.
What sort of work did you do as a child on the farm, chores and things?
Planting, picking potatoes, saving the peat on the peat box, which we used for fuel. And at those times we didn't bale the hay, we put up loose hay, which involved a lot of work in the meadows and that. And a lot of work because of the climate. It was impossible to get sufficient period of dry weather to save it, so that added to the work we had to do. And so the ordinary work on the farm with that the crops involved, and saving the peat in the peat bogs for the fuel.
Mm-hmm. Did you always want to be a priest, even as a child? Was that a later decision that you made?
No. When I, mm-hmm. growing up, even as a teenager, I didn't like priests. I did not. I had nothing against them, but I saw it as their being in their world and I was in mine. And parallel universes, if you like. And but I do remember a priest coming to our parish who had a tremendous interest in the sports we were interested in, and he became our coach. And that was probably the first time somebody had come from that world into mm-hmm. mine. And we had two unbeaten seasons, which of course added to his reputation. And I don't know exactly when or why I made the decision to be a priest, and I think I have that in common with many priests, mm-hmm. if you like. And I thought I was the only one that did it, but I found a lot of my friends did. The only way to be sure would be go to the seminary and you will be fired and then you'll know. And, but they didn't fire us. So. And I would say my being a priest is just my best guess as to what I should be. That's all. Mm-hmm. No absolute certainty.
Interesting. So you came to the United States in 63.
Mm-hmm.
Was that, my question is, you wouldn't have had any direct experience with the Troubles in Ireland concerning just the IRA in North Ireland as it sort of increasing tension throughout the 70s, 80s, 90s?
I would have heard about them, of course. I would have heard them talked about. Even though the people didn't discuss it a lot. I remember one of my neighbors at that particular time all of a sudden disappeared, and I'd heard he had gone to the United States, and then I found out he had to go there because he was a member of the IRA. And so there would be things that would happen that were connected with the war, but never talked about too much. It was something that the people wanted to forget, if you like. And much later on, as I grew up, I became more aware of it. And when I was growing up, grade school with, say, a teenager, there were so many monuments all along the highway to people who had died for Ireland over the years and years, that it was a very fresh memory. And you couldn't help but, in the course of a day, being reminded of the last rebellion or the last ambush or whatever, just through those monuments. And and there were people alive at that time who were involved in the War of Independence, if you like. And it's only a little later on I had a chance to talk to some of them. But when I was growing up very young, they wouldn't talk about it. Mm-hmm. No.
So you actually had the opportunity to talk to some of the veterans?
I did, yeah.
Would you like to talk about that a little bit? Or?
One of the local leaders of the War of Independence, which I didn't remember, but he was a veteran of that, and he was the local blacksmith when I was going to grade school. We passed his blacksmith shop every day. And so he would be seen as a veteran of the War of Independence by the adults, but to us younger people, he was the man who coached the Galway hurling team in 1923 to win the national final. So we saw him from different perspectives, if you like. I remember talking to somebody who was involved in the Civil War, which unfortunately followed the War of Independence. Two sides whether agreed or disagree on the treaty. And he told me he was on the opposite side to De Valera at that time. And a few of them together, their mission was to find and to actually assassinate De Valera. And they had information that he was in this particular house, and they went in, and there was a wake happening at that house. And this man told me their first suspicion was, of course, that this is fake, that the corpse is actually De Valera. So as to avoid suspicion, so they checked the corpse, this man is dead. And they didn't find him in the house, and later on they found that De Valera was in the house. He was standing behind the drapes on the kitchen window. And this man was in his 80s when he told me this, and he said he was always grateful that they never did find him. He didn't want it on his conscience. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting. Wow. When you, so you've had experience as a priest in a lot of communities in Montana.
Mm-hmm.
Could you name anyone as being a particular favorite?
I wouldn't say favorite so much as some of them were unique.
Yeah.
You know, and this is, I mentioned before that the people are so accepting of somebody from a different country, and we feel very much at home very quickly after we come to a new community. And I'd say the most unique place would be Ikalake, because until very recently it was the only county seat in the United States not on a through paved road. The road stopped at the courthouse door. And so you had this community of 600 people at the end of the road, and some days during the winter you go to the grocery store and you find a notice, no bread today, the truck didn't get in because of the snow drifts and what have you. And it was a unique community. Then I was a while in Wolf Point, and fascinating to be so close to the Native Americans. Mm-hmm. Absolutely fascinating. And what I found interesting was, in talking to one of them one time, that There were some similar customs between the Irish and the Native Americans in connection with death and wakes. In the Native American wake, usually the first thing you get when you go in is tobacco. There are loose cigarettes there. The tradition in Ireland was when you went to the house, there was tobacco and they were called clay pipes. They were made out of pottery, but they weren't really finished. And the pipe was filled and you were given it to, and you smoked it and you left the pipe in the house. You didn't take it with you. And another very close thing was the idea of the medicine man or healing. This tradition in Ireland, which is very strong, and I actually believe it myself, that the seventh consecutive son in a family is the gift of healing. And in my native parish at home, there was such a family, seven consecutive sons. By coincidence, the oldest and youngest were priests. And I asked the youngest one time about it, and he said, yeah, it's true. And talking to a Native American one time, he found out I was the seventh in my family. And he said, if I was in his tribe, I would be the medicine man, the seventh, who is a son. I thought it was a close connection in customs.
Yeah. That's really, really interesting. And I've heard that before from people saying that there are remarkable similarities.
Yeah.
And that the Irish, when they come to Montana, tend to actually get along
very well.
Very well with the Native Americans.
Very, very well, yeah. And maybe part of that is, I'm sure you have heard there's such a thing as Indian time. Well, there's Irish time too. The Irish are not very time conscious.
And I also imagine, you know, the Irish having experienced so much, you know, colonial oppression and racism, basically.
We almost had an identical history,
mm-hmm.
almost, because unfortunately for the Native Americans, in the area of education, if you go back far enough, their culture was taken away from them. And the Irish had the same experience, where the language, the music was banned, the sports were banned and that. So I think we see ourselves as having quite a bit in common as regards our history.
Yeah. So the Ekalakan Wolf Point, do you have any other interesting stories about parishes you worked at in Montana?
When I was in Ekalak, my claim to fame is, even though I had never seen baseball in my life, I played for the Ekalak baseball team. That was different. That was different. You know, getting involved in the brandings and the ranch chores, which we didn't have, even though I grew up on a farm. We didn't have things like that.
Yeah. How does ranch life in Montana, how did that strike you when you first came here? I mean, as being different from...
First of all, the size of the ranches.
Mm-hmm.
Because of, we'll say, the rainfall in Ireland, which I believe could be as much as 40 inches a year,
mm-hmm.
The land is more productive. And a drought would be a very rare occurrence. And so... A family can do very, very well on small acreage. But here, just the sheer size of the ranches. And then when I grew up on the farm, it was a very mixed type of farming. And then that has changed in Ireland completely, of course. But then I come out here and I find that they have all their eggs in the one basket. They either have wheat or cattle. You know, just one thing, you know. That struck me as strange, as different, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, and that was even happening back in the 60s.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Mm-hmm. And I also always appreciated, because they helped me out very often, I came to believe that every rancher was a mechanic. And I could see the need of it. They lived so far away from garages and mechanics that they were very self-sufficient when it came to maintaining machinery. And more than once, they fixed my car when I broke down on the highway.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely interesting. I think you mentioned to me once before that you had been in the Roundup area.
I have been in Roundup, yes.
That's where I'm from.
Oh, yes. I spent 5 years in Roundup. Yeah. Five years in Roundup.
What were your impressions of Roundup? It's okay. You don't have to worry about offending me.
Of course, the coal mines weren't going when I got to Roundup. When I got to Roundup, I think the most fascinating thing about it was the name of the town. From the old cowboy movies that I saw when I was a little kid, you know. And I was making arrangements when I was in Roundup for a trip to Ireland with a travel agent in New York who happened to be Irish. And I think we talked more about Ireland than the trip. And so she's trying to get in contact with me. She couldn't, so she eventually called another Irish priest to give me the message. And what she was doing from New York was trying to contact me in a town called Upside Down, Montana. She got mixed up between Roundup and Upside
Down. Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. I think when I was in Roundup, that's the first time I saw an oil well, because north of about 20 miles north of Roundup, there were some oil wells.
Yeah.
And that fascinated me to see an oil well for the first time. Yeah.
You've seen a really vast array of Montana landscapes, though, and it's different. And,
mm-hmm.
and so, you know, Red Lodge is, you know, extremely different than a lot of those, you know, flatter
eastern Montana. This is the first time I've been in the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in the prairie all my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I would feel more at home in the mountains than on the vast expanses of prairies,
mm-hmm.
because that's one of the things my brother noticed when he came out, is traveling long distances without seeing any sign of human habitation.
Yeah.
You would never have that experience in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's eastern Montana was very, very different. Very different.
Yeah, it's got to be almost disconcerting.
A little scary sometimes until I got used to it. Until
mm-hmm.
I got used to it.
And we are back.
Okay.
Okay. So we were talking about your experiences in various Montana parishes.
Mm-hmm.
And I have some questions that I think would be, I think, interesting compared to some of the answers we've gotten from, you know, second and third generation Irish people about this manor. What do you know about your family name and its origins and history?
From what I know, how accurate it is, I'm not quite sure, that our family way back were blacksmiths. And as I understand the different prefixes for Irish names, Fitz and Mac and O, my name in Gaelic has an O in front of it. And then you have some names with Mac, which means direct descendant from, like McNamara.
Mm-hmm.
And O, I think, would be one step removed from a direct descendant.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Fitz, which more or less would almost correspond to somebody who was adopted by a tribe rather than a descendant as such.
Mm-hmm.
So we were blacksmiths way back, associated, I think, with a family, clan, whatever, called Cahan, which is spelled in the Gaelic language C-A-T-A-I-N, which is my name in Gaelic.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And, but in more recent generations, they were all farmers,
mm-hmm.
and nobody continue the trade of blacksmith, as far as I've been able to find out.
Are there any traditional first names or nicknames in your family?
Oh, yeah. Dennis, my own name, where the tradition was that the names were repeated every generation. So I have an uncle who was Dennis, who had an uncle who was Dennis. And so my granduncle, actually, has a street in Waltham outside Boston named after him.
Really?
Yeah.
Why is that?
He lived there, this is going way back, and it's a dead-end street. And in this dead-end street, he built three big apartment houses. And even yet, I made a special trip out there from Boston one time to take a picture of the street sign. It's Craven Circle. He was my granduncle.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What about nicknames?
Not so much nicknames as in the area of County Galway where I was raised, there were a lot of cane families. And they were identified by very often their using just their first name or their middle name. And two neighboring families of canes, I remember, they were known as the Tommy Joes and the Johnos, you know, because that happened to be the first names of the fathers.
Mm-hmm.
And even today we refer to them as such, even though they're all dead, you know.
That's interesting. How about female naming traditions? Any girls' names in your family that are traditional?
The same was true of the girls, that the names were repeated.
Okay.
The names were repeated. That has stopped now, for example, in my brother's kids, my nieces and nephews, there's no repetition of names anymore.
Interesting. Does your family have any special, like, sayings or expressions that are repeated?
I don't know if they're exclusive to the family or whatever, but they had some expressions to describe certain things. If they referred to somebody who didn't seem to have a lot of common sense or did something rather stupid, I know my mother had that expression, "There as I roved out." Now, what that meant, where it came from, I don't know.
"There as I roved out."
"As I roved out." And that meant that person doesn't have a lot of sense, if you like. Now, what the connection is, I don't know. But I grew up hearing that all the time. And they used to have an expression to describe somebody that was friendly, but their friendship wasn't all that genuine. In other words, they would be friends with everybody, but not necessarily. And they used to refer to them as Lana McCree's dog.
Lana McCree's
dog? Yeah. Lana McCree actually in English means love of my heart. And the way they would translate it, my mother told me, was a person who will go halfway the road with everybody. Those were some of the expressions that I remember. Yeah.
That is interesting. I have a question. Since you and the priests, other Irish priests in Montana, used to get together and for Christmas and stuff, were like community wide gatherings for things like Christmas, were those really common when you were growing up in Ireland?
No. And that, speaking of customs that I might be aware of still from Ireland, is it was a very strong tradition in Ireland that you did not visit another family on Christmas Day. That was unheard of. That would be looked upon as a terrible intrusion into the privacy of that family. And I always think of that even now, no matter what parish I've been in, you get invited out to a family for Christmas dinner, and I almost feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
It goes against what I was raised with.
Mm-hmm.
I almost feel I'm intruding into this privacy of this family at this special time, and I find it difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Even after all those years.
That's interesting. Yeah. So, speaking of back home in Ireland, were there any traditional sort of home cures, since you're talking about the seventh son
mm-hmm.
having healing abilities, were there traditional, like, common ailment sort of poultices and things that were
Not so much things associated with this healing that they talked about, like the seventh son.
Mm-hmm.
And that gift of healing seemed to apply only to skin diseases. And this man I asked about it, who was a priest actually, he said, "I just touch it." There's another strong tradition of healing in that sense. Person who is born after their father dies has a gift of healing of ailments of the throat. And there is a neighbor of mine still back home, much, much younger than I am. And he was born after his father died, and I actually asked him about it, and he said yes. Now, I didn't get into too much detail. I wanted to analyze this whole thing, but he didn't want to discuss it. So there was not so much healing with the use of poultices and curing herbs or anything like that. The ones that stand out in my mind are the seventh son and somebody born after their father dies.
Interesting. So are there any commonly held superstitions that you grew up with or even maybe still unconsciously practice today?
Ghost stories, of course, were part of our bringing up. My father believed, it's one of these things he let slip rather than told me one time, strong belief in him and his generation that the most likely person to see a ghost was a priest. Now, what that's founded on, I don't know. I think my mother had a belief in the leprechauns, and again, it's something that she never told me, but I read between the lines, if you like. There was a superstition, would you call it a superstition, connected with Halloween. They baked what they called a brack. It was just a loaf with raisins in it. And in the loaf was baked a ring, a piece of wood, and a piece of cloth. And whoever got the ring and the slice, they're the first to be married. Whoever got the piece of wood was the first to die. And I don't know what happened to the person who got the piece of cloth. And another very strong one, and I think about every 12th day of Christmas, they had the was it prayer or was it superstition of the 12 candles? They would get 12 small candles that would burn for about 15 minutes, and they'd grip the 12 candles on a board, and each candle was named for a family member or close relative until the 12 candles were named. And they were lighted while we were saying the family rosary. And the order in which those candles would burn out would be the order in which those people would die. And that was the night we prayed like we had never prayed in our life. We were too young to know that the candles in the middle obviously would go first. And even after I came out here and my mother continued that tradition, she would let me know the order in which the candles burned out. And I would be always last or next to last. I could have gone first, but she wouldn't tell me. she believed in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. So what led you to believe that your mother believed in the leprechauns? Is there anything she did in particular?
I think it was home on vacation, and I was traveling along the secondary road. It was getting dark, and it was in a place that we were all told was haunted when we were growing up. So it was kind of eerie in that sense, but I didn't believe that anymore. And out in front of me, I saw somebody driving a donkey and cart. And I said, "I'll wait until I go to the turn now and there'll be no problem overtaking." So when I looked up again, it wasn't there anymore. But the obvious reason was it pulled into a gateway that was there. So I went home and I asked my brother, I said, who lives around there? There's a donkey and cart that will be out this late at night. And he couldn't think of anybody. And that's when my mother let it slip that it could have been the leprechauns. And then as regards my father thinking the priests were very likely to see ghosts, I was home again on vacation and there'd been an accident and I was called out to the accident. It was very, very late at night. And so my dad woke up and found what was happening and he says to my oldest brother, go with him, don't let him go alone because priests see things, referring to ghosts.
So were there any particular areas in the area where you grew up that were that you remember as being having particularly vivid ghost stories attached to them?
Yeah, that particular location where supposedly the leprechaun was, very strong belief that that place was haunted, had to do with a rather cruel landlord that lived there one time. There was a house in the area and I was in school with the kids and the light was never turned off in that house, never. I think today they would call it a poltergeist, maybe in the house. But the house is next to a cemetery, so everything would build up towards having something eerie about it anyway. And there were certain places known, if you like, to be haunted. But you never met anybody who saw anything, but you always met people who knew somebody that saw it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You couldn't get that firsthand experience of it for some. And that was very much, we were very, very conscious of that growing up as kids. And I don't think we'd feel comfortable being anywhere close there after dark or anything like that.
Interesting. I have, now that I know that the festival, the Irish festival in Butte is sort of built over the years and it's getting to be a bigger and bigger thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you often get the chance to go up there or go to Butte for St. Paddy's Day or anything like
Never
that?
Never been for St. Paddy's Day, just because of the time of the year.
Yeah.
But I've been at the Reraw, six, seven times, I think, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like it, love it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because Bernadette, yeah, you saw Bernadette at that particular festival. So that, yeah. Before we wrap things up, do you have any other particularly interesting stories about either Ireland or your time being a priest in Montana you'd like to share?
I remember hearing one time, which is true, it's the law in Montana, that if I'm stopped, anybody stopped by a police officer, you're entitled to an interpreter in your native language. And so I thought all I had to do was carry my passport and I'm free. But I asked another police officer and the rest of the law says they can hold me until they find an interpreter. And maybe I'm the only Irish priest, any priest in Montana that was woken up one morning by the governor of Montana.
Really?
How about that? Yeah, Tom Judge. I was visiting some Irish priest friends of mine in Glendive and Tom Judge was there that morning and I was sleeping late or something and they said, Keane's upstairs, Tom, why didn't you go up and wake him up? So I wake up and there's Tom Judge, the governor.
Oh, that's funny.
And before I left for Ireland, first of all, 1963, John Kennedy had been in Ireland for 3 or 4 days. And so I was there during his visit. That was great.
Did you get to see him or shake
hands? I'll tell you now, I can say I got to shake hands with him, but I got to see him because he spent 4 days and you could go various places, but he was in Galway, and after his speech, he was talking to a group of people, and he just put out his hand like that while he kept talking to the people. Anybody going by could shake his hand. So it wasn't that personal, but I did.
Oh, that's great. Oh, my goodness.
And in connection with his visit, there was a souvenir of his visit, which I thought at the time was kind of a crazy one. But if I had one now, it would be a collector's item. They produced these three pictures in the one frame in Ireland for his visit. And picture on one side was St. Patrick. The picture on the other side was John the 23rd, but Kennedy was in the middle. And it's interesting for American tourists, if they go to the cathedral in Galway City, which was built in the 60s, and the Mary Chapel is there, and you have this huge mosaic of Mary, and who's beside Mary? John F. Kennedy. Honestly. Now, that's because the Kennedys gave some money to build the cathedral.
Have you actually ever led mass in Ireland?
When I go home, if one of the priests there wants me to help out on a Sunday, or if he wants to take some time off, I take his place. That is all, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What would you say has been the most striking thing about being a priest in Montana, an Irish priest in Montana?
I think to a certain extent at the beginning we had to learn as we go, if you like. That I was brought up, reared, educated in a totally different culture, and I found the people so patient while I was adjusting, and I had so much to learn from them, as it were. And what amazed me was the dedication of the people in terms of weather and distance, which were not factors at home in our practice of the faith.
Yeah.
But especially in eastern Montana, how they were able to cope with those two things, the weather and the distances, in order to be there on a Sunday, I thought was tremendous, tremendous, yeah.
So if you were to write the history of the Irish in Montana, what would you want to include for future generations?
I think the applying to people before my time, their unbelievable courage to do what they did. Maybe they didn't have much choice in leaving Ireland, but still, despite that, to leave, it took great courage. It took great courage to come as far as Boston, New York, but to come out as far as Montana, that took, to me, unbelievable. They're very courageous people. And just what was in their spirit, if you like, that gave them the courage to do that. I envy them. I envy them. And the other side of the coin is they kept alive a lot of the culture from which they came. They kept it, and I think maybe differently at the beginning, They kept alive their culture without staying apart from the other culture. You know, they blended pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was very important that they did preserve part of the culture. You know, they did preserve part of the culture. Yeah. So they must have had a tremendous, what they would call an Irish chiabrán, love of country that they brought with them,
mm-hmm.
and also love of the country they came to adapt so well. Yeah.
Well, that is a great answer to a rather difficult question. Unless there's anything else you'd like to say, we can call it good for today.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
I'm so happy you didn't ask me what I wanted on my tombstone.